Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the official Tennis.com podcast, featuring professional coach and community leader, Kamau Murray.
Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I am your host, Kamau Murray, and this week we've got a special guest, Andrew Krasny. He is the voice of tennis, the most trusted interviewer in the game. He transitioned from working with Joan Rivers for years into not only commentating for tennis and announcing tennis, but being a full-service tennis aficionado and the most trusted producer in the game. You hear his voice on most big events. You see him at the podium on finals day. You see the players smile when he walks on the court to ask him a question, whether it's in win or they're in defeat, because Andrew knows how to make everybody feel comfortable. Before we talk to Andrew, let's talk about what we just witnessed at the French Open. We talked in January with Pat Cash about Tennis Australia's decision not to let Novak into the country and what impact that could have on history in terms of the Grand Slam title race. You got the Australian Open with no Novak, no Federer. Rafa gets 21 and was almost assured to get 22. I personally predicted Zverev to beat him. And at 6-3 in the first set, it looked like he was going to do it. And up a break in the second, he definitely had an opportunity. So I wasn't that far off. If not for the ankle sprain, I think we were in for a good 4.5 to 5 hours match, which is what we expect and what all the fans wanted to see between two of the best players in the world. And with Iga Świątek, we see her continue her winning streak to 33. And I've had a chance to watch it up close on the court and from afar on the television. And here's what I see. She controls the pace of the match. She plays fast. She makes you play at her pace. She doesn't allow you to slow down, even when you need to. And when you think about somebody who's playing for so much, not only playing for the French Open title, but also playing to keep the streak going, the best way to do it is to not be thinking so much. And I think the pace that she's playing and the pace that she's imposing her opponents gets her on and off the court so fast, helps her remain healthy so she can play 33 straight matches without injury, without being all taped up from toe to shoulder. And I think that's her biggest weapon, is controlling the pace of the match to control her mind and control what she thinks about, what she doesn't think about, and how she's able to just execute. So congratulations to both champions. Enjoy the conversation between me and my brother, Andrew Krasny. Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamau Murray, and we are here with the man. Well, let me not say the man. The voice, the myth, the voice of tennis in your favorite stops on tour, both home and abroad. The most coveted tennis event producer in the world. The person on tour that probably makes the players, win or lose, feel most comfortable when he walks out on the court with his microphone, hoping not to make them cry more than they already want to. The dude that goes to refill his plate at breakfast 4 times before the matches start. Andrew Krasny, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kamau, thank you. You know, it's funny. Everything that you said was a lot of fluff, but one that meant a lot to me was that maybe my voice does bring some comfort when a player walks out on a court. That actually really touched me. So I think that was pretty cool. So thank you.
Well, you know, I will say, when you hear your voice, you know two things. A, it's a big time event. And B, the promoter spent a lot of cash.
Well, you know, you've written me a check. But I do 250s, 500s, 1000s. I look, you know, Joan Rivers taught me early in my career that if your week is open on your calendar and someone's willing to pay you, you got to say, you can't say no to anybody. But it does, of late, I guess you can say, I think it was in Chicago at one of your events, someone walked up to me from the WTA and they're like, wow, Kamau brought in the big guns. I'm like, no, Kamau, I can't say no to Kamau no matter what. So thank you.
So you brought up Joan Rivers, right? And when you look at your career, you know, when you hang out with us tennis players, you're kind of slumming it because you're used to big Hollywood, Joan Rivers, Martin Short. Tell us about those days. Obviously, we all want a good Joan Rivers story.
Well, it's funny. First of all, you'd have to have a three-hour show if you wanted good Joan Rivers stories, which I'll give you a couple. But, you know, early in my career, when I was in my late 20s, I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to be in front of people. But you can't just wake up in the morning and decide you want to be a performer and be successful at it. So I started producing on talk shows, was working with Lisa Gibbons, who we just had a big reunion a couple of weeks ago. I was a producer on a talk show with Lisa Gibbons, and being a sensitive guy, believe it or not, behind all my sarcasm, I was always producing the sensitive shows, cancer topics or missing children. It was a talk show back in the 90s. And took a lot of work home with me. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to go down that path in my career. And I was watching our warm-up guy one day, the guy who comes out to warm up an audience before a TV show starts, and knew right then and there that was my calling at the time, and approached Lisa during our Christmas hiatus and asked her if I could be the warm-up guy instead of produce. She thought I was crazy, but she's like, if that's what you want to do, go for it. And that was the beginning in my late 20s of being in front of an audience and understanding that you can be in front of an audience and at the same time not make it all about you, right? Because you want to be a warm-up guy, but you never want to outshine the star of the show. And it's the same 25, 30 years later in my tennis career where I want to have fun, I want to have the microphone, but I never want to make it bigger than the players. It's all about the players to me and the fans.
So how did you transition from that to tennis, right? Because I always am amazed. Well, obviously we talk about how small of a circle and like a tight-knit group and like family that tennis is. And it is so hard to penetrate and to sort of get in this family, right? And how did you penetrate this market coming from Joan Rivers and Martin Short?
Well, it wasn't.
And being a mediocre tennis player. Sorry, no.
I'm an average. I'm for USTA rankings and stuff. I'm a 4.5. Maybe on my best day, doubles in like a 5.0. But you probably don't know what that is because that's like civilian lingo.
I actually know what a 4.5 is, and I think you just gave yourself a 1 point inflation.
No, really, true 4.5. Honest. But the older I get, you know, you spend your whole life trying to get to a number. And then you get there, and then all you want to do is go back down so you can finally win some matches. But so to make a long story short, I was producing on a talk show for Martin Short and went on an audition and got a job hosting a dating show on the USA Network. It was called Crush. It was 20 years ago and finally got my own show, hosted that for a season. That show got canceled after a season, and I had just started playing tennis competitively on a civilian level and was at a tennis tournament at UCLA. Bob Kramer put on a great event at UCLA, and a friend of mine worked for Bob Kramer. And I remember sitting there with a group of friends watching this match come out, and it was Andre Agassi, and this guy was like in his 80s, introduced Andre Agassi. And I looked down at the court and I said, that's the job I want to do. I want to interview tennis players. I want to welcome crowds. I want to entertain crowds between matches. I want to be that warm-up guy, but I want to apply it to tennis. And Bob Kramer gave me an opportunity. I was also writing a radio show and producing a radio show with Joan Rivers. She gave me a week off with pay. That's the kind of woman Joan Rivers was, because she knew I wanted to find my passion. And I volunteered at Bob Kramer's tournament on a side court for a couple of years. And I could have died right there a happy man, because here I am. I'm 30 years old, I'm in my 30s, I'm watching Andre Agassi, Pete Sampras, I'm getting free clothes, I'm interviewing them, I'm getting free coupons to go to California Pizza Kitchen. I mean, I was the happiest guy, and I was getting paid by Joan Rivers to work for Bob Kramer for free. And long story short, that turned into a tournament in Carson, that turned into a tournament in Amelia Island, that turned into La Costa, turned into the WTA Finals, turned into Indian Wells, Miami, and it exploded and became almost a full-time job until about 7 or 8 years ago, where tennis became full-time. I started to produce some of the events that I'm involved with.
So what do we have to do to go back to the free t-shirt and free California Pizza Kitchen coupons to get you to work an event? I mean, I want to go back to those days.
So that was, I mean, listen, to be able to, listen, we all want to find a career that we're passionate about. And I talk to kids now about finding something that you can't just say you want to do something. You've got to really, in any sport or any profession, you've got to really want to do it. You've got to eat, drink, and sleep it, everything, right? It's got to be what courses blood through your veins. And tennis was that for me. I was a super fan. I would go to watch Arantxa play. I would go to watch Monica play, Pete Sampras, Andre Agassi, Pat Rafter. I was watching them all play tennis. And when I saw a slight crack in a door open where I could possibly incorporate that into my career, I ran through that door. And it didn't happen overnight. You know, each tournament grew into more tournaments, and trust also doesn't happen overnight. As you say, you know, to penetrate that circle, you have to show respect. You have to understand the sport. You have to understand personalities and egos. I mean, it's a very complex aspect of a sport that a lot of people don't realize. But I think what players expect the most from someone in my position is to understand the match, what occurred, how they won the match, understand their accomplishments and their accolades, and respecting that you're going to always ask them a question that's never going to put them on the spot. And my job is to present players in the best possible light that I can do.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
So tell me about a time, your favorite interview, because you've obviously had the opportunity to interview the greatest players in a manner that most don't get to because of your trust level, right? So, you know, we see Serena win a match and we see you walk on with the microphone and we see her smile, right?
Right.
And we don't get that too often, right? You can tell that there's a comfortability there between you and Serena, Maria. Tell us about one of your most favorite interviews.
Well, that warms my heart that you notice the smile that players have when they walk on the court. You know, I could write a book, maybe I will one day, about when my relationship with each player that I've worked with in 20 years went from just being a colleague to maybe a little bit of a friend or someone that they can trust. I think there's a moment with each player individually that I could say happened in order to make that transition to where that we had a trusting back and forth reciprocal friendship. Serena, back in the day, believe it or not, I was so new in my career, Kamau, that I didn't even put two and two together. And I was introducing, she was warming up with a player. I couldn't even tell you who it was. It was in Carson, California, brand new in my career. And I'm introducing the player she's warming up against. And in her bio, the opponent, I mentioned that she had beaten Venus, which was a rookie mistake. Now I would take that out, right? I would never, but I just was reading. I didn't even write the bio. I think someone wrote it and I didn't catch it. And I said it and I got a look from Serena like, I'm gonna cut you. It was like you could see through the fog. And after that match, I said, Serena, I owe you an apology. And it was rookie of me. And she's like, oh, I heard that. I said, well, what can I do? And she goes, well, I like teddy bears. And I went out and bought her a teddy bear, brought it to her the next day and said, I owe you an apology. I should never have done that. And she laughed. I would tell you that there's moments, there's just things that have happened in the past, right? You know, when Serena, do you remember when Serena got ejected from the US Open? There was a lot of hate and I felt bad for her because I felt that people want to cancel you and judge you by a moment of misjudgment or a lapse in judgment. And I made t-shirts and wore them at my tennis club and said, free Serena. I made I was teaching a hosting class in LA. I had a student that made t-shirts and I made them, free Serena. I wore them to my tennis club, wore them everywhere. And of course I told Renee Stubbs, and Renee Stubbs, who will tell you if she comes on your show that she cannot keep a secret, she went and told Serena. And Serena comes up to me in Doha and says, I heard you made a t-shirt that says my name on it. Like, what's that about? And I gave her one. And that was another big moment where she felt that maybe there's someone on her side who works in our position. And I felt bad for her. And that was, gosh, how many years ago? 12, 13 years ago, 14 years ago? There's been moments in my career where I feel very blessed to do what I do. Kim Clijsters had given her last interview at the time at the US Open. She was playing doubles with one of the Bryan brothers. I interviewed her. When I realized it was her last match, I had tears running down my face, which I think made her realize that she's played a significant part in my life. And when you grow those relationships with these players, we spend a lot more time together behind the scenes than we do in front of the scenes, as you know. And we travel together, we fly together, we see each other in airport lounges, we see each other at breakfast, we spend hours on rainy days, that we have relationships that I think deserve maintenance and deserve trust and loyalty.
So you mentioned breakfast. What's your favorite breakfast spot? I always ask people, what's their favorite stop on tour? You're obviously conflicted because you're going to say a place that employs you, like Indian Wells, Miami, those kind of places. So I don't want to ask a question, but what's your, I swear, every time at breakfast, you spend there for 3 hours and you get four plates, but you stay skinny. So what's your favorite hotel where you go back for that free breakfast buffet?
Well, we had, first of all, it's not free, right? Someone's paying for it.
The tournament's paying for it.
Because in Guadalajara, we had a late start and we usually worked late at night. So you get up early in the morning at a beautiful hotel like we were in Guadalajara, and you and I would see each other going back and forth to the buffet. By the way, you had to be there to see me there for 3 hours. So, but I, you know, Guadalajara was so funny. I ordered guacamole and didn't realize that it came with grasshoppers in it, which freaked me out. Oh yeah.
Gross.
Grasshoppers in my guacamole.
Gross.
But no, I loved it. Listen, we're very lucky. Some of the tournaments that I work for give me a hard time that I want to stay at nicer hotels. I don't love to travel. So in order to travel, I want to be as comfortable as I can be so I can deliver the best in that I have in me. So I do get lucky and very blessed to stay at nice hotels where I can run into people like you at breakfast who like to out me on podcasts about how much time I like to spend at breakfast.
Well, if I notice how many times you go to breakfast over a week long, that means it was a good week. That means I was also there.
Right. So, all the way through to the final because Sloan won Guadalajara.
Who, let me just out you one more time. You're in charge of the event. And this brings me to my next question. You're in charge of the event. Luckily, it wasn't a crucial moment. I think it was like 2-1. And the music comes on in the middle of the point. Luckily, it was on Buzkova serve.
Okay.
And I was like, Andrew, what the hell?
Okay. Well, I'm going to be the first to tell you that there are times where that's my fault and times where it's not. Luckily, 99% of the time, it's not. But Guadalajara, when this happened, I was not producing that event. I was just the host. And somebody up in a booth pushed the wrong button. But I will tell you, in Miami this last spring, somebody was testing a commercial that I was voiceover. I did the voiceover for, and it's in the middle of a Medvedev match. The commercial comes on, just the sound. And whose voice is it but mine? And, you know, Daniil's agent, Ollie, comes up to me and says, smooth move, Andrew. I'm like, I swear it wasn't me. He goes, it was your voice. I'm like, but it wasn't me. But I will tell you, in Indian Wells one year, Kamal, I had a microphone under my arm and a volunteer had dropped a stack of paper and I bent down to help her. And I'm like, here, let me help you. The microphone turned on and Caroline Wozniacki is going to serve in front of 13,000 people. And my voice comes on saying, here, let me help you. And she catches the ball and looks around like, did Andrew just did Andrew say, let me help you? Around and yeah, it was me. It was my microphone. So now most of my sound guys mute me whenever possible, but we make mistakes. You know, we're human beings, and a DJ will think he's testing something and he won't push the right mute button and it'll go out in the middle of a match.
Has it ever happened in your career where it's cost the server the game?
Okay,
which consequently can cost the match.
Okay, so my biggest fear in the whole world is that a mistake that I will make or someone on my team will make, and that the match would sway in the other direction, and then the player will go to press and bring it up. That's been my biggest fear in my entire career, and by the grace of God, knock on wood, that's never happened. So like I introduced Novak Djokovic from being from Belgium instead of Belgrade, you know, 18 years ago. And he threw a tennis ball at me and hit me. And I'm like, oh my God, please win the match. So it never comes up again. Please win the match. And he won the match. So that's never happened.
So I remember the first time I really sort of got to know you was Montreal 2018. We're there all week.
Not Montreal.
When was it?
It had to have been another city because I've never done Montreal.
Miami 2018.
Miami. Okay.
Miami 2018.
Were we still on Key Biscayne?
We were still at Crandon Park.
Okay.
Key Biscayne. All the way to the end. Won the tournament. And by the end of the tournament, I'm like, okay, I can almost recite this playlist by heart. Who chose this music? Like, it could not have been more white. So tell me how you choose the music, because the sport's getting younger, Andrew. So right. Is the music for the players or is it music for the fans?
Okay, so I will probably get in trouble for saying this, but an event that first of all, you want a nice mix where the music is for everybody. But my music that I choose, and I have a horrible taste in music, but we have to keep it as clean as possible. We can't have any questionable lyrics. My music is 99.9% directed towards our fans. If I know a song that a player loves, and some tournaments we've had asked players to give us their requests, we'll play it in their warm-up. But generally, we try and play music that extends across generations, that just makes people smile and make them happy. And I will beg to differ with you that my music is as blanco as you say it is. But now you're making me go take a look at my iPod, which by the way, I left in Chicago and it was held for ransom, but I got it back finally. No, I try and keep
Until they plugged it in and listened to the music and said, okay, old man from Palm Springs, you can have it back.
Right. But listen, first of all, I don't play the music that I love. I play stuff that from the Bee Gees to Bruno Mars to 70s music, 80s, 90s music. I agree with you. Like my volley, I probably need to work on my selection of music, but I have to be really careful because, you know, the minute I let my guard down, Kamau, there's questionable lyrics and I get letters that complain about me, or a chair umpire, a line judge who will remain nameless came up to me and said, I've got this great song. And she gave me a memory stick and I plugged it into my computer and I played it. And you know, the song that's like, I think it goes, I want to be a millionaire so bleeping bad. You remember that song?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so she gave me the X-rated version of it and I just, and I played it. And it's like, I want to be a billionaire so effing bad, went out to 2,500 people in San Jose and I got in trouble. Or Bruno Mars has a couple songs that says like lonely ass B words and I got to take that out. I can't play that kind of stuff. So I've got to be very, very bubblegum.
Now the good ones are when you see the player on changeover kind of swaying a little bit,
right.
Win or lose. I'm like, okay, now you hit the mark. But I do think it's an important role because sometimes, you know, the changeovers, the bathroom breaks, which we're seeing a lot more of, right. The injury timeouts, you have a key role in entertaining the crowd.
Right.
And your music selection has to sort of speak to that. Now, let me ask you this, because some, you know, now that I'm sort of on the other side of the camera, you always wonder like, it's 5-6. Maybe we shouldn't go to commercial.
Right.
Maybe we should stay on it.
Right.
Right. and watch the player on the changeover, watch their expression, watch whether they pull out their notebook, watch the fan experience, right? Like, you know, when Delpo plays, you can see the fans like go crazy on the changeover, and that becomes part of the story. Exactly. Or like French Open 2018, when the crowd is saying, see him on up, right? That kind of thing. Those are moments when you don't want to go to commercial, and what you do gets put on front stage. Do you feel like we need to be more strategic and when we go to commercial, when we should let the experience play out in front of us?
Right. Well, listen, it's some of that's not in my control, right? I can't control what Ross Schneiderman or my big bosses at Tennis Channel do. If they have to go
shout out to the big bosses,
They got to go out to commercial. But what I can control is what happens on inside the stadium. And, you know, fortunately I work with the best show caller in the business, you know, Todd Noonan, Patty Jacobson, and they're in the moment. They understand what's going on. So if the, you know, Roger Federer is about to get bounced out of the tournament, and if he breaks, he stays in, we're not going to play Sweet Caroline in the changeover. We're not going to run a feminine hygiene commercial and everybody be like, what the heck are you thinking? We'll pull the commercial. We'll play a good song. We'll play like Eye of the Tiger or this Girl is on Fire. Like we'll play something that, I have a horrible taste in music. And you will say it's the smaller events where you can bag on my music. Indian Wells in Miami, we've got professional DJs now who are playing majorly cool music. Man, we can't let them do DJ drops and stuff like that, which I didn't know what a DJ drop was until about a year and a half ago.
I remember.
You remember? but we do really try our hardest to match the moment. And, you know, I think, to tell you the truth, Kamau, there's nowhere else in the world that I would rather be than at the tournament that I'm working at. And I try my hardest to make sure that everybody who's in our stadium realizes and understands that that's what we're doing for them. Because I believe that everyone who's there, who spent all that money to watch Rafa play or Simona or Sloan or Maria or Serena, they've spent a lot of their hard-earned money and they could be watching it at home very easily. And I want to make sure that I've given them everything that they deserve.
So you've obviously had a chance to be courtside for a lot of tennis, right? Men's and women's. Great matches. And sometimes, you know, you're oblivious that you're really watching history. And sometimes right. You're not. I remember 2018 Montreal final. Sloan was playing Simona Halep. And I was sitting there with Othman, who's, you know, co-coaching with me, Sloan. And I sat back next to him and I said, this is the best. I said, win or lose, this is the best match, women's match of the year. They are going at it, right? So, tell us about the most historic match that you've been a part of. And you were like aware, like, damn, I'm watching history.
Well, there's a few, right? And these are the moments where I wish I was almost savant-like. Like you take a look at Joel Drucker, who can tell you every match and every historic moment in the last 30 years. The significant moments for me, there was a big match, you know, Victoria Azarenka playing Paula Badosa at Indian Wells was an epic final where we thought we were seeing. You hear it on the men's side a lot, but you don't always hear it on the women's where someone says, that's the best women's match I've ever seen. That's the best match I've seen in the season. I think the Venus and Serena matches have been epic because you know that they're so rare. But to me, the most historic moment for me on court, hands down in my entire career, was Serena's return to Indian Wells. She walked out on that. You know, I was not there when the first incident occurred. But I was there for the entire boycott. Mm. So here I am, a huge fan of Serena's, love her to death, and one of my favorite tournaments in the whole world she wants nothing to do with. And it was a very sensitive area for me. I almost never wanted to talk to her about Indian Wells because if I knew how she felt. So when the deal was brokered, and I use that as a facetious term, when the deal was brokered, however it went down, to get Serena to look beyond and to make her way back to Indian Wells. When she walked out on court and I introduced her, I was reduced to a puddle of tears. I looked at Isha, her sister, and we sobbed. And it was, to me, one of the most significant moments whether she won or lost the match. And she almost lost the match. She was playing Monica Niculescu, who can drive the most sane person completely insane by just one shot of the ball on each side, right? It was windy and Serena had her work cut out for her. But Serena coming back to Indian Wells and allowing all of us who love her to show her that love, to me was the biggest, one of the most, if not the most moving moments of my career. Mm.
So you've also been public about struggle with anxiety, and like mental health is sort of like, is a humongous thing amongst tennis players, especially, right? Because, you know, you walk out onto the court, it's only you, right? And sometimes you wish you could like crawl under the player bench and hide, right? And there literally is no place to hide once a player steps out onto that court, right? Right. Tell us about sort of your struggle with anxiety. Does it come during events? Are you like, oh, shit, I gotta like make sure I get this right? Like, tell us about where it comes out and how you see it now evolving into a sport. Because I feel like every tournament, we can pick out a player who had a major opportunity or a major meltdown, and it was because maybe having a panic attack or an anxiety attack on the court. And now, before, we would say a player choked. And now it's coming out that they're more comfortable saying, I had a panic attack or I had an anxiety attack.
Well, first of all, I think it's incredible that we can be on a platform like this and talk about mental illness, which to me, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we weren't doing, right? So it's important that we all talk about it. And my personal battle was over the last 10, 15, 20 years where I've suffered from anxiety. Luckily for me, it never happens while I'm on court, never happens when I'm working. Usually my anxieties were leaving home and on, you know, the journey of getting somewhere to me was rough. Once I was there for a couple of days, I was fine. But I have to give a lot of credit to Marty Fish, who when I read his, you know, his op-ed about his struggles and his battles, made me feel a lot less unusual, right? It made me feel that I'm not the only one in the world. And nobody wants to struggle with a disease. No one wants to struggle with anything in life that we can't overcome. And how it manifests itself into each of us are very, very different. So in the, you know, there's a very fine line between choking a match because you were anxious and then saying that you had an anxiety attack. And to each individual, an anxiety attack is different to each individual. What constitutes the real true definition of an anxiety attack is if you're completely crippled and can't get up, can't get out of bed, don't want to leave. There are different levels of anxiety attacks, and I'm not in any position to classify them for you at all. I do have to say it's interesting now to see how players feel it's safe to be able to discuss them. And obviously Naomi is the one who comes the most to the forefront. When I think about Naomi Osaka, who I'm a huge fan of, and it kills me to see that she's been struggling in the last couple of years. But on another hand, it would be a lot worse for her if she wasn't able to express herself. It's those of us who can't express ourselves and talk about it, where it kills us inside and can cause serious damage. And the fact that players are being vocal and articulate about it, I have to give them kudos. And I do hope that there aren't players out there who will use it as an excuse and that they'll be honest about it. But I don't really think that too many players are out there using it as a crutch or as an excuse, because nobody wants to make up that they are suffering from an ailment or a disease. It's a pretty serious issue. And I'm just happy that we can all talk about it and not feel the shame. You know, we have this stigma in society that you can't talk about mental illness, but we can talk about having a headache and take an Advil. We can talk about having acid reflux and taking Xantex, right? But we can't necessarily talk about medication that has to do with mental illness because we have this stigma in society that it means you're weak or that there's something wrong with you. To me, it just means that you might be wired different. And if there's a medication that helps untangle your wires, then why not take it?
Well, I think that now anxiety or even just emotion is a humongous part of coaching, right? And you look at some of people's performances in Grand Slam finals that are so abnormal from what you saw with them in the previous six matches to get to the final.
Right.
And, you know, it was like, you know, I've obviously coached somebody in two Slam finals. And the number one job even bigger than the X's and O's, right? Because if you get to the seventh match, which I always say, you got to win seven matches, right? Mm-hmm. When you get to the seventh match, you clearly are hitting the ball well enough mm-hmm. to be there. Mm-hmm. You clearly can sort of have a feel for the entire court that day, but you may not have a feel for just the emotion involved in that day. And I think the biggest thing, or when I look at some of these slam finals and I see 1-2, 2-2, 3-1, you know, in some of these scores, you look like they didn't coach the emotions, right? And sort of the feeling of what it's going to feel like on that day. And it's probably too much time on the X's and O's.
Right.
And it goes on both sides, right? Not coaching the emotion, the player not being honest and vulnerable and saying, hey guys, I'm scared, right? You know what I mean? And I think when you look, that I think is a bigger part of coaching the game now than ever before. It's just saying, all right, strategically, here's what you got to do, right? But then even more than that, you spend 10 minutes on that, and then the rest of the evening before the match and the morning of the match is talking about how you're going to feel, or when you feel this, do this, right? You know what I mean? And how to plan for that emotion that's going to come out. So, and that could be dealing with potential panic attack or dealing with anxiety with finishing a match, right? Being up 5-2 serving, knowing this is your first slam or whatever it is. I mean, the anxiety of having a false expectation appearing real, I call it fear.
Right,
can cripple somebody, right? And I think before it was just, oh, they just choked in the final. It's like, the emotions weren't coached.
Right. Well, it's interesting when you talk about how are you passionate, or how can you be the most passionate about a sport where you're not supposed to be emotional, right? Or you take a look at what happened with Coco and Iga at the end of the match. First of all, my heart broke for Coco. I don't think anybody, no matter how strong they are, could have done any damage against Iga Świątek right now. It's spectacular to see there's a feather in her hand. The way that racket moves and the way she has full understanding of the moment, it's spectacular to watch her. And she's an incredible kid. And then to watch Coco, what happened today, it was heartbreaking. I don't think she choked the match away. I think that Iga Świątek played a level above her. But my point is, getting to the trophy presentation, Coco let her emotions out. You looked at her dad was crying. Iga started crying, and Iga said, I told Coco not to cry, and here I am crying. So I think that we need to allow ourselves to express ourselves emotionally, and we need to embrace it. And it's okay to cry, and it's okay to admit that you have anxieties. And part of her training regimen, and part of all these players, I mean, I'm not a coach, Kamal, and I've had the privilege of watching you coach and watching a lot of coaches. Working on mental strength is as important as working on your forehand and your fitness and your overheads and your all the things that you work on. I think that mental health has to be up there as an equally as important to the things that you work on physically. And I think that that's obviously something that's been done with Iga. She travels with a full-time psychologist, which is incredible. I should be traveling.
Hey, if one more song comes on in the middle of my player's match, you're going to need a therapist. You're going to need.
That's rough. But I will say, it's interesting.
Did you see the look I gave you when it happened? I was like.
I know. But that's what's funny, because the earlier parts of my career, I was responsible for all of that. So now I could be at a match and the music comes on and Roger Federer is playing, and he'll look right at me like, what happened, Andrew? I'm like, I had nothing. It's not me. I swear. And he goes, I don't care. Go fix it. So it's, you never want that to happen. But anyway, I have to say, back to mental health, is I'm really glad that it's out in the forefront and people are afraid to talk about it. I think the biggest enemy in the world right now for all of us, and I know it's making a lot of people wealthy, and I know it's helping a lot of people on the platform that we're on right now to become more successful. But I think that social media is a huge culprit. And you take a look back on the days of Arantxa and Steffi, not that I want to sound old or feel old, but Lindsay, and like, what were they doing, Kamal, when they were finished with their matches, when they won or they lost it? I mean, they weren't going back to the locker room and sifting through a stack of 17 newspapers, were they? Mm-hmm. Right? There was no internet, there was no social media. So when I hear that people are keeping Carlos away from social media, I'm like, hell yeah. I think that's the best thing I've heard in 5 years.
Yeah, I think when you check the draw and you feel like you've got a good opportunity to win this tournament and thing, or even if you make it to the second week and it's a whole new tournament, mm-hmm. and we just need to not screw it up for the next three or four matches.
Yep.
That's when, for me as a coach, I started to say, all right, new rule, no social media. Because a conversation can change a mindset, right?
Right.
And winning a slam is all about mindset, especially from the second week on. And when you open up that phone and you got a million followers or 200,000 followers,
okay,
you have the opportunity to have a conversation, even if it's one way,
right?
With 200,000 people, and 100,000 of it is going to be negative.
Right.
And that does not help what we're trying to accomplish.
Or how about Kamau, if one is wrong? For example, yeah. with what happened with Naomi in March out at Indian Wells, one person's voice said something that sent her off. And the way that I chose to handle it, on social media the next day, I had maybe 500 compliments and someone went off on me, and that affected my day or my day and a half. And that's where I decided, you know what? I'm not looking at Instagram anymore, because that one voice can be the voice that gets you. And that one voice can be the one that costs you a tournament. So you're absolutely right. But then that raises a question. The more successful a player becomes, the more famous a player becomes, the more powerful they become, who wants to say no to them? Who's afraid to say no to them? And you look at that whole, that's a big issue. So how do you tell someone like Naomi to not look at her phone?
And then, well, here's the thing. I think that, yes, the player is the boss because the player pays you.
Right.
However, for these 2 weeks, I'm the boss, right? You're the CEO and like your team is the board of directors.
Okay.
Right. And the board of directors can fire the CEO, right? They kind of tell the CEO, here's what needs to happen. And when the team around the player is on the same page, then the player doesn't have an opportunity to really go against it.
Right.
It's when the physio, the trainer, the therapist, the coach are all on different pages and one person mm-hmm. is trying to secure their job and be the friend or be the soft place for that player. That's when you start to get, okay, we're not going to win because everybody's got to be on the same page. And I think that, you know, coaches win when the players win, right? We want bonus.
Right.
Right. Those bonuses get bigger in the second week. And so right. I'm going to tell you nothing that is going to hurt you nor me, right? Because when you win, I win. And I think that those players who have these magical runs, which let's be honest, in this day and age, there aren't a lot of players who win multiple slams other than Osaka, Barty, now Swiatek. But everybody else is like one slam, then another one in a couple years. And when they relinquish control, then I think they're at their best. And it's kind of like, you know, the coach has to look at their, and especially for players who don't look at the draw. You get the draw. You see the lineup of players or the matchups, or even after the first round, when half the seeds start losing. That's when the coach goes to the player and says, all right, you don't look at the draw, but we got a good opportunity. We just can't screw it up. Right. So here's what we're going to do. Right. And when the player gives up that control, then I think you see these runs that become really magical. And I think that as these champions start to get younger and younger and younger, they're going to have to start relinquishing control, especially as it relates to what enters their mind, right? And, you know, I always like to say, I've been your age before. You haven't been my age.
Right.
And so at the end of the day, just trust that I'm here for you.
See, I think that's fascinating to hear. And it's, you can see that, right? In the two players that we're all talking about now, the most, right, are Iga and Carlos. And you can see that clearly that's happening. And it's spectacular to see. And it's
and even you have sponsor obligations. But for these 2 weeks, I will call this sponsor. I will call that sponsor and say, no poster after the tournament. Because nobody wins if you don't win, right? And if you do win, then those you know, every one match, the followers go up 10% or 20%, right? So that one post that you want me to post on Wednesday or Thursday, if you wait till Monday after the tournament, it'll have 20% greater value, right? It'll have more meaning, bigger platform, because at the end of the 2 weeks, two people get the microphone, champion right. and finalist, right. right? And so that's sort of what I think everyone has to get on board with, because we got to become a better balance between allowing hundreds of thousands of people to have conversations with our players
right.
when they go to their hotel room at night,
right?
Right, over social media. And then getting to the win and protecting their mindset. You know what I mean? Because it's just amazing. And players got to understand how important that the mental part of it is. And Iga clearly has figured it out.
Right.
That she's, and if you look at the way she's playing, Andrew, she's playing so fast, like just the time in the matches. She's playing so fast. It's almost like she's not giving herself time to think.
Right.
Time to panic and time to get nervous.
But that's interesting because, Kamal, I've noticed that when you've suffered from anxiety, it takes time to suffer from anxiety. When we, at least for me, I can't speak about anybody else's issues, but when I get down on myself, or if I've gone through and I've overcome a bad issue of anxiety years ago, but it's when I have the time to do it, right? It's when you're not keeping yourself active, you're not exercising, you're not out doing things. You asked me earlier, I think before we got on our call, or even during our chat, did anxiety ever affect me? It never affects me while I'm working because I don't have time. Mm-hmm. It's when we're by ourselves or when we're not being constructive, we're not being creative, that the little space between our ears tends to play games and tricks on ourselves, where we have to keep a firm grasp on that, so to speak. So I think that managing a player's time, I've known from day one, long before social media, that I would never text a player during a Grand Slam or during a tournament. That's like their coveted time. I don't want to get into Sloane's head and tell her that I love that outfit she was wearing. I don't want to get into her head during that. My favorite story about Sloane ever made me think of that as I ran in. I think you were there. We were at a hotel in New York and I looked at her. I was like, "You look so good today." And she looked right back at me and she goes, "I know." And Sybil, her mom, looks back at me. She's like, "I don't know who she got that from." I'm like, "Really?" She's funny. So listen, you just have to, I think players do need, and teams need to understand that we need to respect everyone's space. And like I said, social media to me, I think is one of the greatest inventions of all time. But I also think it's like alcohol, right? Like alcohol is great to have a little drink and get a little buzz maybe, but it's also one of the worst things that's ever happened to mankind. And I think that social media is the same thing. It's just as dangerous.
Well, let me ask you this. The start of a new year is always dangerous for you because you change your hair color. Since I've known you, you've had 5 or 6 different hair colors.
No, that's not true.
So what's your favorite hair color?
First of all, Oh God.
I know you're trying to like find the fountain of youth, right? And see which one makes you look younger and thinner.
This is not a hair color, Kamal. This is 100% 57-year-old Jew.
Right.
That's the name on the bottle. I've had gray hair since I was in college. Okay. And when you're 21 years old or 22, you're not digging having gray hair. If I could go back in my life, I wouldn't have cared, but I cared. So for years, I was messing around and putting color in my hair. No one knew because I was young. So in the last couple of years, as I'm getting older, it's been harder and harder. And I just, after the WTA finals in Guadalajara last year, I said, I'm never going to worry about what my hair looks like again as long as I live. And it took 3 months to get 30 years of crud out of my hair. And this is all I got left. So thank you for bringing that up.
I'm just saying, you know, we're friends, so I got to be honest. You know,
no, I love it.
My least favorite was the jet black.
It was never jet black. It might have looked jet black because it was a little too brown. Right. But it was never jet black. But I have to tell you, it was one of the most liberating things I've ever done. I have a T-shirt that says "Openly Gray." So thank you for noticing. Everyone in the family loves it, and I've gotten some letters from some fans, tennis fans. I don't like to say that I have fans because it's really not my show at all what I'm doing. I'm the luckiest guy in the whole world, but fans of our sport have reached out on social media and said, "We're digging what you're doing, so keep doing it." So I feel pretty lucky.
Well,
I don't see too much hair up there.
Man, that's called stress.
Is it?
That's called bad genes. My dad's bald, so that's called bad genes and stress. I mean, you know, coaching these girls, man, it drive you crazy.
Kamau, can I tell you, and this isn't, I know you're going to get mad at me for turning the tables back on you, but to see what you're doing in the inner cities and what you've done in Chicago for underprivileged kids who normally wouldn't have an opportunity to play a very expensive sport, I think you're one of the coolest guys in the world. And I hope that people realize what you do instead of just sitting in a seat in a box at a tennis tournament coaching a player to a final. There's a lot more to Kamau than I think people realize.
Oh, man, let me tell you. Number one, thank you. Number two, shoot me. If I had to do it all over again, I can't promise that I would, because it is the most stressful. I mean, being a Black person trying to break into this sport, who didn't play on tour, right? If you played on tour, you won a Grand Slam, whatever. You're grandfathered into the club. But coming where I come from, it's pretty hard. Even having the credentials that I have, it's still hard. Right. But it's fun. And, you know, I like sort of getting inside the club now and trying to make a way for others. I've got several of my students who now work on tour for other players.
That's cool. Right?
One of my students works for Naomi Osaka, right? Good job referral, having a good time. Nice. Went with her to a new agency. So that's going well. So that's good. Off of a trust and a recommendation, right? And so I value those opportunities to seeing, you know, kids come up in this city, this neighborhood, and then be able to get them to, you know, into tennis other than playing, right? Because it is only for the truly gifted that right. can actually make money on the court, on television. So my last question for you is, you are a professional at this, right? From your work with TC, from the announcing, there's so many opportunities for tennis players, collegiate tennis players, to stay in the game, even though they probably aren't good enough to make it on tour. Even me, when I first did my first stint at TC, and I did, you know, the play-by-play, the commentating, I was like, damn, there's an art to this, right? And I'm not good at it, right? And I was like, you start to respect sort of the art form and not just somebody picking up a microphone and being good at it and being funny. What piece of advice can you give to tennis people who want to get a job in tennis, perhaps not on the court, but behind the microphone or behind the camera or even production?
Okay, so I think you need to have people in your life who are honest with you about what your strengths and your weaknesses are, right? So, you know, back in the day, if we're watching these, like American Idol, for example, right? And a kid comes on and says, you know, everyone says I'm the best singer in the whole world. And then they get on the show and they can't carry a tune and they've become the joke of the season, right? You have to understand what you're good at. You have to understand, and being open and honest and having that conversation is not an easy thing to do. I know what I'm good at. I know what I'm not good at. I would never pretend, right? I'm not good at color commentating or play-by-play. I don't have that skill set. I know that I'm a funny guy. I was able to make a living by my humor. I know that I love tennis, and I know that I love and understand the passion of a fan who wants to be at a tournament. So I know my lanes, right? You've got to find your lane, find what you're passionate at, find what you're good at and what you're willing to change and learn to get better at. And there's so many different avenues in our sport where there's room for things to do. I'll give you an example of a guy who I think he played college. Phil Doerr, who's head of marketing at the Indian Wells Tournament, played college, probably an excellent tennis player, but I'm guessing, I don't know him well enough to say this, might not been as good enough to go pro. So he went into tennis as a career and went to work for the ATP, wherever he has landed, whatever he did, he's now head of marketing for the Indian Wells Tournament, for the BNP Paribas Open Tournament. So he's taken a love for tennis and was an excellent player, but maybe not good enough to be a professional player. And now he's found another area in the sport to be at the top of his game to market the most prestigious tournament on tour. And you look around at our colleagues who we work with, and there are a lot of them. You take a look at Donna Kelso, who's a WTA supervisor. She was a former player. Or you look at Pam Whitecross. Pam used to play professional tennis. And you look at all these people who have figured out, what can I do to stay in a sport that I eat, drink, and sleep, but can't maybe do it the way that I wanted to, but let me find another way to do it that's our job in life, I think, is to find a career and a job that we, you know, it could be 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm in the middle of Doha, Qatar, homesick and having anxieties, but I have to stop and say to myself, you know what? Shut up. You're getting paid to watch Sloan Stephens play Kim Clijsters in a tennis match. Like, what are you thinking? Like, shut up and enjoy the ride and find out what you're good at. And there are so many, listen, whether it's in finance or whether it's in production, we have huge amounts of jobs in production, Kamau. You can be a stage manager. You can be, there's 25 different jobs in production where you can run video clips and run playback clips and you can create the words that get written on the bottom of a television screen. You can be a director, a producer, an editor. There's a million skill sets that you can apply towards a sport that you love. And there's tons of opportunities to do it. And I'll talk to anybody about it. I love it. I'm the luckiest guy in the whole world. The thing that gets to me is when a 20-year-old thinks that they have a skill set that they don't, and they don't want to hear advice. That to me is the frustrating part. And the older I'm getting, I lose a little bit of patience with that. I'm like, I wish I was a little more patient with that kind of mindset. But there are lots of opportunities in our sport, Kamau, as you'll be one to tell, for sure.
Well, you've been very patient with me. I appreciate your time. I always enjoy seeing you on site because, you know, you need a friend that's going to be kind. You need to know the music's going to be up to par. Always love it when we're like in an empty stadium and I'm looking for entertainment and the changeover comes and it's like some Justin Bieber song that you chose. Secret, I love Justin Bieber, so I don't mind those Biebers. But I thank you for spending so much time with us.
You're a believer. You're a believer. I love it. I didn't know you were a believer.
Oh, man. Acapulco 2016, I fell in love with Bieber.
There you go.
That was like my first. I didn't even know it was him. It was, can you say I'm sorry? Whatever it is.
And he loves tennis. That's my favorite thing. When we find out stars that love our sport and we can do the crossover, that to me that's like the icing on the cake. I was at, what's her name? Mariska Hargitay, who plays Olivia Benson on Law & Order. Uh-huh. I was at Laver Cup in Boston last year and I'm sitting in I'm sitting courtside and I turn around like this to stretch a little bit and literally right behind me is Mariska Hargitay. I'm like, are you kidding me? I fanned out completely. And I love when I find big stars that love our sport. Like Gladys Knight loves tennis and, you know, you see who's at these tennis tournaments. It's fun when we see stars and who make the crossover. Justin Bieber loves tennis, by the way.
And it's fun when you're there from the start to finish. So yeah. I thank you for your time, Andrew. This has been a tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamau Murray, and we've had the privilege of being with the voice of tennis, Andrew Krasny.
Kamau, I want to say thank you to the A-list and the B-list celebrity who canceled on you, so I got you today.
Yeah, you know, you're on my standby list. And I was like, who can I call? I'm just kidding. Thank you, brother.
Well, anytime.
All right. Love you, brother. Thank you.
Thanks, buddy. Love you, too. Be good.